From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Late last year, Governor Whitmer revoked a contract with Enbridge for its underwater pipeline.
She said Enbridge had persistently and incurably violated the terms of the easement agreement and called Line 5 an unreasonable risk to the Great Lakes.
Today, Enbridge responds saying it will not comply. We'll get the latest. Plus, how far does a one-time $600 stimulus check really go?
People have lost, you know, substantial portions of their income. And frankly, the federal and state relief has not been enough to fill that gap.
Also, cash bail programs in Michigan's legal system.
What cash bail does is it creates an inherently inequitable system and one that ultimately doesn't keep us safe because we're not making these determinations based on dangerousness. What we're doing is holding people simply because of the size of their bank account.
Those stories and more straight ahead. Welcome to Stateside. I'm April Baer. Later on the show, we'll talk about the future of controversial cash bail programs in our state's legal system.
Poor people, working class people, they may sit in jail for days or weeks or months, even when they are accused of a relatively minor crime and even when they pose no threat to the community, again, before they've been convicted of anything.
That's coming up later in the show. But first, over the last couple of weeks, Americans have been receiving their second COVID relief stimulus checks from the federal government, this time at $600 for individuals who make $75,000 or less in income. It's not clear whether there will be another stimulus check coming. So that's been one for $1,200 so far, and now one for $600 to serve as a cushion for folks and stimulate the economy. We wanted to dig further into what economic hardship looks like in Michigan right now and whether those stimulus checks help in the way that we wish they would. Here to talk more about it is Kyle DeBuck, Director of Policy, Advocacy, and Government Relations with the United Way for Southeast Michigan. United Way oversees the ALICE report, which is an annual snapshot of families in the state that are technically living above the poverty line but struggling to make ends meet month to month. Kyle, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you for having me.
So, according to the ALICE report, more than 40% of our households in Michigan struggle to pay bills and put food on the table every month. Could you talk a little bit more about what the broad view is of poverty here in Michigan?
Sure. So I can tell you that, you know, as an organization, that we're working on the ground every day to meet the needs of people in our community. And, you know, both in the programs we provide and our partners provide, you know, we can see exactly what families are struggling with. And it's really what's laid out in the ALICE report. So as you said, we knew that, you know, before the first case of COVID-19 came to Michigan, we already had 44% of households in our state struggling to cover the cost of a bare bones, no frills household survival budget. Whereas, you know, federal poverty would tell you only 14% of our state are living at or below poverty. You have an additional 29% of people, the overwhelming majority of whom are working or were working before the pandemic hit, who were living in or on the edge of crisis.
Are most of these families, would you say that these families most often are living in urban, suburban, or rural areas?
Families living below the ALICE survivability threshold are in every single community in every county across the state. It's one of the benefits of the report is that it shows you know, that folks living below that threshold are everywhere, and it really obliterates, you know, some common misconceptions about poverty, what poverty looks like, where poverty is, and who's struggling to pay their basic monthly bills, especially amongst those who are doing everything right, who are going to work, who are you know, trying to pay their bills and improve their income, and they're just operating in a system that's not setting them up to succeed. And this pandemic has exacerbated that all across the state, all across the country.
What are the most frequent areas of concern when we talk about economic hardship in Michigan communities? Yeah, I mean, would you rate food insecurity or rent or utilities anywhere in some kind of ranking right now?
What we've seen, you know, through our 2-1-1 call service, which is, you know, a 24/7 assistance line that can connect people to supports available in their area in a time of need or crisis. We've seen a dramatic influx of increase in calls, and it is very much about utility assistance, rental assistance, and food assistance. And we also know from our own experiences as a service provider and our partners' experiences that they have been overwhelmed with an increase in calls. And again, this is not just from the pandemic, but the fact that so many people in our state were already living just on that edge of crisis. And now through wage loss, furlough, job loss, or the inability to go to work, even if they had the opportunity because their children are at home, people have lost, you know, substantial portions of their income. And frankly, the federal and state relief has not been enough to fill that gap.
Well, let's talk about that. When we discuss stimulus checks, what can $600 do for a family living slightly above the poverty guideline level?
I don't want to disregard that a bipartisan compromise was reached. So some relief, you know, is certainly valuable, but it doesn't get nearly to the point that you're even covering a family's monthly costs. So according to the Alice report, you know, in Michigan, and you can break it down to county or local level, but you have for an individual, $1,700 is the cost for one person to survive, you know, just covering their basic monthly expenses. For a family of four, that's $5,000. So a $600 stimulus check doesn't cover, even for a single individual, a half of their monthly expenses.
So one of the things that was on my mind as I was thinking about the stimulus checks as they were debated in Congress is, you know, families who are living close to the poverty line very often, you know, might get into a situation where they miss a month of rent or they're behind on their bank accounts and fees might start racking up either for utilities or rent or banking. Is it possible that families might be so far in arrears that the $600 might just be eaten up on covering their costs for trying to survive for the past couple of months before the checks even arrived?
Oh, absolutely. And what we know is, you know, according to a recent Moody's Analytics study reported in the Washington Post, they estimate about 12 million Americans are on average more than $5,000 behind on rent. So that comes to about $72 billion in need compared to the $25 billion in rental assistance that was passed in this last package. So we know that families are falling further and further behind as this goes on. And we know that the things we've done have been done to protect public health and prevent the spread of the pandemic. But at the same time, we have to make sure that we are filling this financial gap for families so that when we can open things back up, we don't have a massive foreclosure, eviction crisis that we're now dealing with. And Congress only extended the eviction moratorium through the end of this month. And so that's going to have to be dealt with.
Kyle, do you see any communities or community groups trying different and creative ways to combat poverty right now? Anything that you see trying to address the problem head on?
I think there's a lot of innovative you know, programming that's going on beyond just, you know, safety net programming, which is, you know, designed to prevent people from you know, becoming completely food insecure or being homeless. You know, there's micro grant programs. Job training and upskilling programs that you know, I think have value. But what we see in the Alice report is a real systemic issue, not that, you know, 44% of our households are not lacking some basic skill or some magic formula that leads to success. When we have 44% of families not able to cover the cost of a basic household budget, that is a massive systemic issue that has to be dealt with through public policy and better practices in employment. And I'm hopeful that once we get through this, you know, this crisis that has exposed so many of these flaws in our system and the fact that so many people were living right there on the edge, that we can start having conversations about who we want to be going forward and helping to address these basic household costs and closing that gap between what it costs a family to survive and what people are actually earning.
There are many countries who chose during COVID to provide a weekly stimulus check to help citizens stay home and make it possible for them to pay their bills. Do you see those approaches having tangible outcomes that are different than what we're experiencing right now here in the States?
I think it's clear if folks are able to shelter in place and quarantine because their income has been supplemented, that's going to help us get through the crisis quicker, help slow the spread of the disease, and while we wait for the vaccination to get to a point where we've reached herd immunity. Unfortunately, the way we've approached it here, that doesn't appear to be the case. We know that, you know, folks have had to continue working, and, you know, that's, I think, a flaw that has driven you know, kind of the disproportionate spread of the pandemic in our country than we've seen in others.
I guess some of this might depend on the details, but I'm just curious, in policy circles, when people talk about ramping up our safety net in terms of rent assistance, in terms of utility assistance and food security, and we think about that guaranteed basic income, how do policy folks think about which one would be more expensive or perhaps more cost effective?
You know, I don't know that the policy debate's even gotten to a place where we're really looking at a cost-benefit analysis. I think there's so much that's driven by ideology that we can't even have a conversation about, you know, what is going to provide the best, you know, solution to this issue of 44% of households not able to cover their most basic needs. You know, even in Congress, with the increased unemployment check, the debate turned from how do we keep households stable through this crisis to we're paying people not to work. And especially in the midst of a pandemic, that seemed an odd place and a counterproductive place for the conversation to go, when the priority needed to be on keeping people safe, preventing the spread of the disease, and ensuring that we were meeting household needs while we managed through this crisis together. So I would like to say that, you know, we could have a real productive policy conversation about, you know, some of these innovative concepts. And I can't even say necessarily, you know, where United Way would land, because the data and you know, real tangible policy conversation has yet to be had, certainly in Michigan. What's been exposed by this crisis is real deep flaws and inequities in our system, that, you know, too many folks are living day to day on the edge of crisis, that, you know, we and our partners in the philanthropic sector, you know, working every day to meet those needs and fill those gaps. But what we need are real tangible systemic changes to address these issues. We need to address the affordability of child care. We need to ensure families are food secure. We need to ensure folks are jobs are paying, you know, a reasonable living wage. To get to a place where folks are not, you know, one missed paycheck or a week's reduced hours away from, you know, crisis, from missing their rent, from being under the threat of eviction. So there's a lot to do once we get through this, and we have to have that conversation and learn from this going forward.
Kyle Dubuck of United Way of Southeast Michigan. Kyle, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
Still to come, Enbridge says it's going to ignore the state's revocation of a contract that allowed the company to operate the Line 5 pipeline in the Great Lakes. That conversation when we return. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. The Canadian pipeline company Enbridge issued a statement today saying it will continue to operate Line 5 in the Straits of Mackinac, despite a demand by Governor Gretchen Whitmer to shut it down by May. The Environment Report's Lester Graham joins me now with a few more details on this. Hi, Lester.
Hi, April.
So, Lester, what's going on with this?
Well, Governor Gretchen Whitmer announced that she was revoking and terminating the easement for Enbridge's Line 5 back in November. Now, if you don't know, that's the dual crude oil and natural gas liquids pipelines that sit on the bottom of the Straits of Mackinac. And the bottom is actually State of Michigan property, so Enbridge had to get an easement. And she said Enbridge had persistently and incurably violated the terms of the easement agreement and called Line 5 an unreasonable risk to the Great Lakes. So Enbridge says, nope, not going to do that. Ryan Duffy is a spokesperson for Enbridge. He says there's no existing violations of the terms of the easement.
Well, Enbridge is meeting all of its commitment to the state, and the state has failed to show otherwise. The state failed to provide any evidence of noncompliance with the easement.
Currently.
That's correct. Yeah.
So, Lester, what argument is Enbridge making for its decision to refuse to comply?
Well, basically, it says the state doesn't have the authority. It says the Federal Pipeline Safety Act preempts Michigan's attempt to enforce its own safety standards or to shut it down. A few weeks ago, it asked a federal judge to throw out the state's lawsuit regarding the demand that Line 5 be shut down. And Ryan Duffy says Enbridge has an agreement with the state, which was agreed to under the Rick Snyder administration, and that's the pipeline company's course of action.
So we remain very much committed to continuing to operate, and we remain committed to the Great Lakes Tunnel Project, which is the long-term solution and addresses all of these issues and ultimately makes the pipeline that's operated safely for more than six decades even safer.
What exactly does Ryan Duffy mean by addresses all the issues? What kinds of issues?
Well, Enbridge says the state of Michigan has been ignoring the extensive measures it's taken to avoid things such as another anchor striking the pipeline sitting on the bottom of the Straits of Mackinac, and making sure that there are enough supports in place for the pipelines, and that places where pipeline coating was missing have been prepared, and so forth.
Well, what kinds of measures has Enbridge been doing to try to, for example, prevent anchor strikes?
Yeah, I was actually up there a few months ago. Enbridge wanted to show reporters what it was doing about that. So I got on an Enbridge boat, and we trailed another Enbridge safety inspection boat, which contacts cargo freighters and other big ships and asks permission to circle around them to see that they're not dragging anchors or lines that might damage Line 5. The ironic thing, though, is the second time Line 5 was struck, it was by contractors working for Enbridge.
Ugh. So what exactly has been the reaction to this statement from Enbridge that they're refusing to shut down Line 5?
Well, the governor's office says it has no comment. Environmental groups do have comments. Let me grab the sheet here. This is from Oil and Water Don't Mix, an activist group, an environmental group that's been against Line 5 all along. And it says, the Canadian oil transport giant's desperate attempt to weaponize United States federal courts and bludgeon Michigan with an army of corporate lawyers is a delay tactic that will ultimately fail. And then Mike Schreiberg, he's the Great Lakes Regional Director of the National Wildlife Federation. In a statement, he says, this is a desperate move by Enbridge Energy to keep its dangerous pipeline, posing an unacceptable risk to the Great Lakes and communities, jobs, drinking water, and wildlife dependent on them. Enbridge knows it has a weak case because it relies on trying to take away Michigan's ability to protect its own waters. So that's pretty strong language from both of those groups. Of course, there are other groups, you know, construction workers and some unions that really want the Great Lakes tunnel that will house a new Line 5, because that'll mean a lot of jobs over a few years.
Lester, when Governor Whitmer took office, she promised to get the pipeline out of the Great Lakes. There were some environmental groups who were worried that she was going to be soft on Enbridge because of the union's interest in Enbridge's business and business pressure.
Yep.
And yet she has been quite the adversary.
Yeah, it's been surprising because a lot of environmentalists were pointing out to me, she's not saying shut down Line 5 anymore like she did during the campaign. She's saying we've got to get the oil out of the water. And they thought that that was a nod to the tunnel. So I think it came as a bit of a surprise to a lot of folks that she did actually call for the revocation and termination of the easement and to shut down Line 5 by May.
So is there an obvious next move for the state, legally or otherwise?
I don't know. We'll have to see if the U.S. District Court will dismiss or support the state of Michigan's claims about the violations of the terms of the 1953 easement. And that's what we're talking about, a pipeline that's been in the water since 1953. So there's some concern about the age of the pipeline, despite the fact, as Ryan Duffy says, Enbridge believes they've operated it safely during that entire time.
Even more reasons why 2021 will be interesting. Lester, thank you.
No, thank you.
The Environment Report's Lester Graham. If there's one thing Michiganders can agree on, it's our love and cherishing feelings for the Great Lakes. However, since the opening of the St. Lawrence Seaway in 1959, there are a lot of invasive species that have made their way to Michigan via ballast water from ships. If you've ever cut your foot on a zebra mussel, you know what I'm talking about. And if you do any reading about the biology of the lakes, you know just how devastating those mussels have been. Although our waters are clearer because of them, they're not necessarily more healthy. The EPA is proposing some new rules regarding ballast water. And there are many groups and some Great Lakes governors, including Governor Whitmer, who are pushing back on the proposed changes. With us today is National Wildlife Federation's Policy Director, Mark Smith. Mark, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you. I'm glad to be on.
First of all, for those who don't follow shipping in the lakes very much, can you explain sort of what ballast water is and why people in Michigan should care about it?
Sure. Well, it's really easy. Essentially, big vessels, ships that come from all over the world, have to take on water into the ballast of their tanks in order to balance themselves in the water. So when they approach a port, when they unload their cargo, they're imbalanced. So they have to take on the water surrounding them into their ballast tanks to make them more balanced. And then when they are en route, they, depending on whether they have cargo on or they don't have cargo on, it's just a question of discharging that water out before they take on new cargo. So it's just a way to, for the ships to actually balance themselves in the water.
And the ballast water tends to carry all sorts of species, some of which might be microbial and very small, and some of which might be larger. What kind of invasive species have come to Michigan via ballast water?
Yeah, and that's the big problem with ballast water, is that it's not just taking in water. It's taking in every single organism, bacteria, virus that is in that water into the tank. And then when they discharge it into a new water, they're introducing an invasive species to a new water body. And probably the most notorious poster child of invasive species here in the Great Lakes are the zebra mussels. And everyone who lives in the Great Lakes and has spent time on the Great Lakes are pretty much aware that in some places, instead of sand on the Great Lakes, we actually have crushed zebra mussel shells as serving as our beach. They also attach themselves to lots of intakes for municipal purposes. Industry has pipes that they have to spend hundreds of millions of dollars each year to clean zebra mussels off their pipes, as well as commercial and recreational boaters who have to clean the hulls where zebra mussels attach themselves. So they're the poster child for what invasive species are here in the Great Lakes and the poster child for ballast water introductions of them.
You know, species are mobile, and I don't know. I mean, I see, as much as this has been one of the great environmental threats to the lake of past decades, the movement of species is not exactly new. What's different about the movement of species via ballast water that didn't happen pre-contact?
Well, with the opening of the St. Lawrence Seaway in the late 50s, it really opened up the Great Lakes and our region and our economy to a worldwide commerce. And not only did we exchange goods and increase our trade, but we also brought in a whole different harm to our environment and our economy by the introduction of invasive species. These are species that are not from here, and some that are introduced from across the world and come here are benign. They're not harmful. But a majority of them are, and they really take a toll on our economy and our way of life up here. And, you know, they are moved around from, you know, lake to lake. And so we have ocean-going ships, which are called salties, that they bring them in. But we also have vessels here in the Great Lakes called lakers, which pull in ballast water and move the invasive species from one lake to the other. So when you have vehicles like lakers moving them around across the Great Lakes, the spread is astronomical. And it's no longer a question of trying to keep them out, but it's managing them. And millions of dollars are spent each year on simply trying to manage them. The impact on tourism, our quality of life, and, you know, fishing. We have a $7 billion fishing industry in the Great Lakes. We have a $15 billion boating industry. So it really does take a hard undermining of our quality of life and economic vitality here in the region.
How have ballast water discharge rules changed over the years?
Well, it's interesting. EPA was reluctantly, Environmental Protection Agency, was reluctantly dragged into the need to actually regulate ballast water. It wasn't until a series of lawsuits in the 1990s that basically said that invasive species that are discharged into freshwater are essentially a biological pollutant, and therefore they should be regulated under the Clean Water Act. So EPA was basically dragged into this, and as a result, every 5 years since the 1990s, EPA was issuing a permit for ballast water for ships that was basically inadequate. It did not do enough to keep them out of new waters. So through a series of lawsuits from various groups, including the National Wildlife Federation over the years, we really continue to make EPA issue a stronger ballast water permit. It's been going on for almost 30 plus years. We've gotten stronger protections and rules put out by EPA, but never strong enough to keep them out and really fully protect the Great Lakes and the economy. So it's been for 30 plus years where we've been trying to make sure that EPA issues a strong standard that is balanced, that allows for commerce to continue, that allows for that commerce to continue, that does not undermine the economy and our ecology here in the Great Lakes.
So we've got a set of rules that have been shown to be effective. And we're coming up to the end of one president's time in office. Why is the EPA considering changing these rules now?
Well, EPA was required to issue a standard from legislation that passed in 2018. It's called the Vessel Incidental Discharge Act, VIDA. And that law basically said that EPA must issue a standard that is protective of the Great Lakes, but also regulates all vessels that operate within the Great Lakes over a certain size. We're talking the big ocean-going vessels and the big lake-only vessels, our lakers. And that was Congress's intent because there was so much back and forth between industry, between EPA, between conservation communities that were challenging standards, and we weren't really getting anywhere. So Congress stepped in and tried to create a new regime that would be more protective and regulate all vessels. And so EPA was required to do this. Unfortunately, when they issued their draft standard, October 2019, they didn't follow what Congress intended it to do. And so it's inefficient and it's ineffective. And it's not surprising. I think that they are trying to finalize this rule, but also a handful of other environmental rules before the new Biden administration takes over in a few weeks. So they're trying to ram this thing through as fast as they can. And it's unfortunate because at the end of the day, the permit and the program that they're proposing will not be strong enough to keep our Great Lakes protected from invasive species.
What's your sense of how the incoming Biden administration might or might not take action on these rules?
Well, nothing's a given. We have a lot of optimism that the Biden EPA will look at this standard very differently than what the Trump administration has. If you look at the Trump administration's rule proposal, it could be written by the shipping industry. And we think that the Biden EPA will take a harder look at this and probably try to seek a little more balance and more protection and follow the intention of what Congress wanted and that all vessels should be regulated, because the Trump administration's proposal exempted Lakers from this proposal, which, if you think about it, they are the biggest transport of invasive species in the Great Lakes. The Lakers did not introduce them, but they certainly move around them, and there's science to back that up. There's been many studies that suggest that Lakers are almost the biggest vector to carry invasive species from lake to lake. So that's probably the biggest difference, what we'll see from a Biden EPA. I think that they will have a different perspective. I think they will try to seek more balance than what the Trump administration has proposed.
Do you see any easy fixes or places to compromise with the Lakers or other players who are involved in the rulemaking?
I do. I think there's always room for compromise. And, you know, it's not a yes or no. It's not they versus us. It really is, what is the common ground? We know we need the shipping industry in this region. They are a vital component of our economy. No one is saying to shut them down. No one is saying that they cannot operate. What we are saying is that there needs to be rules in place so that the ships can operate in a way that does not undermine our economy in the Great Lakes. And there are technologies out there that the shipping industry can put on their ships that could control or at least try to reduce the amount of invasive species that are discharged into the water. The U.S. Coast Guard has certified a handful of technologies that could potentially be placed on these ships, whether it's ultraviolet radiation from some sort of chemical concentrations that are mitigated before they're discharged into the Great Lakes. There is technology, and there's best available technology out there that EPA did not actually consider when issuing this standard. So there's no silver bullet that's going to stop immediate introductions of invasive species. The only way we're going to get 100% assurance that that's going to happen is if you just don't have any discharge at all. And at this point, that's not a reality. So in the interim, before we can get to a silver bullet, we have to put on technologies on ships that give us some protections, because right now we just don't. And saying no to technology on a ship is not the compromise. It's not the pragmatic approach forward. And, you know, groups like National Wildlife Federation and a lot of members of Congress just want technology on the ships so they can see, does it work? Does it not work? What can we learn from this? And then if after 5 years of a technology on a ship, we could possibly assess, was that good enough? You know, what could we do better? And that's what we're asking for. And I think that's why we're a little upset and frustrated. After all these years, we're still seeing an EPA issuing out a standard that is not looking forward and taking into account the best available technology out there to help reduce the chance that invasive species are introduced through ballast water into the Great Lakes.
Mark Smith of the National Wildlife Federation, thank you for talking to us about this.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
We're always glad to hear your takes, whether it's the post-COVID economy, protests, what's happening to kids or seniors during the pandemic, or anything else that's on your mind. Send us an email. The address is stateside@michiganradio.org. You can leave comments on the Michigan Radio Facebook page or hit us on Twitter. Our handle is Stateside Radio. Up next, Washtenaw County's prosecutor moves his office toward elimination of cash bail. He says it's something the county can afford to do.
Between the fact that this is not a major driver of revenue for the county and the fact that we're not going to have to be holding people in jail and they're going to continue to be taxpayers while they're awaiting trial, we'll come out ahead of this in terms of the monetary considerations.
Beyond that, he says it's the right thing to do. More on that in a moment. We'll be right back. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Last election season, there was an issue that came up in quite a few election contests in and around the Michigan legal system. And it's the practice of requiring cash bail for defendants in our county jails. Washtenaw County is becoming the first in the state to abolish a cash bail system, or at least try to cut it back as much as possible on the recommendation of prosecutors. Eli Savitt is the county's newly sworn prosecutor, and he joins us today. Eli, welcome back to Stateside.
Thank you again for having me.
Why is cash bail a problem?
So I think it's important to take a step back and think about what cash bail really is. Cash bail is a system in which you are charged or arrested for a crime and you are held in jail before being convicted of anything until and unless you can come up with a certain amount of money out of your bank account to pay your way out. Now, if you think about what that does, it means that poorer people, working class people, they may sit in jail for days or weeks or months even when they are accused of a relatively minor crime, and even when they pose no threat to the community, again, before they've been convicted of anything. At the same time, a wealthy person, even somebody who is charged with a very serious crime and poses a danger to the community, they're able to buy their way out. So what cash bail does is it creates an inherently inequitable system and one that ultimately doesn't keep us safe because we're not making these determinations based on dangerousness. What we're doing is holding people simply because of the size of their bank account. And in my view, that is wrong. The data has shown that it does not promote public safety. And so we are not seeking it anymore in my prosecutor's office.
So as you direct your staff to tell judges, we don't think that these defendants should be asked for cash bail, judges may still have a dilemma on their hands in trying to ensure that some defendants who may be, say, for example, a flight risk or pose a danger to the community, that they show up for trial. What are the judges' remaining alternatives?
So I want to be clear about this. Not seeking cash bail does not mean that we think that the jailhouse doors should be opened and that everybody who is pending trial should go free. There are people who pose a risk to our community that are awaiting trial. There are people who pose a flight risk. But we should be making determinations about whether to hold somebody and what conditions we can impose to keep the community safe based on their dangerousness or based on their flight risk, not based on how much money they have. So there are a number of options that you have at your disposal. One may be a GPS tether that you have to wear that ensures that you stay in the community, that it may ensure that you don't have contact with certain folks. One may be house arrest. You can require somebody pre-trial to remain in their home. You might want something like alcohol or drug testing if the reason that somebody is getting into trouble is because they were using substances. You might want, and this is particularly true in domestic violence related cases, you'd want a no contact order saying that you can't have any contact with the alleged survivor of the crime. And in very serious cases, you can seek to hold somebody pending trial just categorically without any money being a part of the equation, if that is what's necessary. But our position is money just shouldn't play a role. We need individualized determinations for how and what conditions we need to put on folks to keep our community safe. It should be based on their actual dangerousness or flight risk, not based on the size of their bank account.
Don't Washtenaw County's judges already have the option of pretrial release? Why is it that that isn't giving us the results that you want?
Sure. And look, the ultimate decision is, of course, up to a judge. But when prosecutors are advocating for something, it's the people of the state of Michigan that is bringing the case. And when they're saying, you know, we want a $25,000 cash bond or a $50,000 cash bond or a $1,000 cash bond, that is, you know, the state of Michigan putting on the record that that is what they think is necessary. And so judges tend to take that seriously. Of course, the ultimate decision is, as it's always been, in the hands of the judges, but we are going to be advocating for a system that doesn't take wealth into account. And what we've seen in other places is, you know, look, if both sides in the courtroom are sort of agreeing on something, judges tend not to go in the opposite direction. Of course, they always have the authority. I want to be clear on that. It is ultimately the judge's responsibility. But, you know, we have fundamentally an adversarial system in this country. And if both sides are agreeing on something and there's no real conflict on that, judges tend to follow the direction of the parties.
So even if prosecutors and defense attorneys are in harmony on this, there is not a judge on the bench that wants someone who was in their court to go out and reoffend. Is it possible that judges will still want to err on the side of caution and may just release fewer defendants?
That look, I can't speak for judges, and I would not speak for judges. But what I will say is I've had conversations with our judges here in Washtenaw County. We are fortunate here to have a group of judges that really appreciates the sort of cascading consequences that can accrue from pretrial detention. The data, for example, shows that, you know, if you are held in jail for even a day or two pre-trial and you work a shift job, you're working class, you are at serious risk of losing your job. You are at serious risk of losing your housing. Your kids' lives could be affected. Your kids may have to switch schools, go live with relatives. And in the best of circumstances, switching schools in the middle of the year results in 6 months loss of academic growth. Our judges here that I've been meeting with, they get that. And you know, so I'm confident and I'm hopeful that we'll be able to set a path forward where, you know, we are really imposing the least restrictive conditions that ensure public safety. That's my goal too. You say there's not a judge that wants something bad to happen when they were in their courtroom. There's not a prosecutor that does either. And we're of course keeping community safety front and center in all of our determinations, but we also have to take very seriously the cascading adverse consequences of cash bail on our communities. And that's why we saw fit to move in this direction.
Right. If you eliminate cash bonds, you also eliminate or at least largely reduce the role of bail bondsmen in the equation. Can you be sure that Washtenaw County will have the ecosystem it needs to track down defendants with less financial incentive for a bail bondsman?
Yeah. So look, the data on this is actually pretty clear, though it intuitively makes sense to a lot of people that you would show up for court if you had some financial stake there, or if there was a bail bondsman that was giving you the incentive. The truth of the matter is, multiple studies have been done, and multiple jurisdictions have adopted a cash bailless approach, and they have not seen any rise in the number of people who are skipping out on their court dates. The experience of Washington, D.C. is probably the most instructive. Washington, D.C. has not had a cash bail system for 30 years now, and they do not have non-appearance rates any higher than any place else. They did not see the rate of non-appearance for court go up after they eliminated cash bail. What really makes a difference in terms of getting people to court is taking care of some of the barriers that may prevent them from going to court. It's things like childcare. It's things like transportation. It's even as simple as a text message reminder to the defendant to show up for court. And one thing I'm very grateful for is the Bail Project, which is a national organization that will bail people out and then provide them those sort of services to make sure that they come back for their court date.
It's been very active in Michigan. Yeah.
Yeah, and they've taken a look at Washtenaw County. They said, look, even though we're not going to have to pay the bail for a lot of these folks because you're moving beyond a bail system, we're still going to help and we're still going to provide those services to make sure that people get back into court. That's what really works. And the data is pretty clear on this. So I'm confident that we're not going to have a rise in non-appearance rates with that ecosystem and them doing their great work here in Washtenaw County.
What's your estimate about how much less revenue will be flowing into the court system as a result of a reduction in cash bonds?
So it's a great question, and this is one thing that's often misconstrued around bond, because bond is not a major driver of revenue. When you pay a cash bond, the idea is that you get it back if you show up for court and if you abide by your bond conditions. So the bottom line to the county really is negligible in terms of what we'd be losing. And on the other side of the equation, by the way, is the fact that we're not going to be housing people in the jail anymore, which can be tremendously expensive. And by the way, we're keeping people, if we can safely release them in their jobs, in their houses, they can continue to be taxpayers in Washtenaw County. And so on net, between the fact that this is not a major driver of revenue for the county and the fact that we're not going to have to be holding people in jail and they're going to continue to be taxpayers while they're awaiting trial, we'll come out ahead of this in terms of the monetary considerations.
I was interested to learn that you have a new partner in this work. You made a hire in your office of Victoria Burton Harris, who people will remember challenged the incumbent Wayne County prosecutor in last year's primaries. What does she bring into your office?
So, I could go on and on about Victoria, but not only is she a tremendously brilliant lawyer and legal thinker, and she's a great manager and, is just on top of everything in the office, she's also just fundamentally a warm personality that cares about people and that cares about doing justice. She is, the best partner that I could ask for in this work. We ran very similar campaigns for prosecuting attorney. We see eye to eye on all of the issues, and she's somebody that really sees the whole ecosystem in which we're operating. She sees the impact the criminal justice system has on things like housing and education and employment opportunities. She understands the impact that it can have on families. And she is committed, as I am, to moving in a restorative and rehabilitative direction. She's laser focused, as I am, on ending racial and socioeconomic inequities in our justice system. So I am just as thrilled as I could be that she decided to come on board here in Washtenaw County, and I'm confident that we're going to really do good things together.
Washtenaw County Prosecutor Eli Savitt, hey, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you again for having me. It's my pleasure.
For more on the broader context of this and other reforms in the new year, we're turning now to attorney Kimberly Budden. She's policy counsel with the American Civil Liberties Union of Michigan. Kimberly, welcome to Stateside.
Thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
The new plan in Washtenaw County is the first of its kind so far in the state. I wanted to ask your assessment of whether it's something that could be easily implemented on a statewide level.
Absolutely. And we're so excited to hear about what's happening in Washtenaw. And actually, we've seen other prosecutors who are recently elected, like in Oakland County, make pledges to do very similar things where they want to tackle incarceration and racial disparities by tackling the cash bail system. And certainly, it takes a lot of work. This takes a complete reworking of how our minds think about Michigan's pretrial system and cash bail. But this is something that we're seeing happen in various cities across the country, and certainly something that's feasible.
You know, the lobbying has been pretty hot and heavy in some other states where cash bail has been abolished. Who profits from the cash bail system?
Well, I think the easiest answer there is the bail bondsman industry. But at the end of the day, we all really lose, because if we're locking people up and depriving people of their freedom, that also shows that, or research shows that that ends up having a negative effect on recidivism rates. So the longer people are behind bars where they don't need to be, the more likely they are to actually commit crimes in the future, not to mention the impact that that has on people's families, their ability to get employment. A lot of people lose their jobs, their houses, and even potentially their children. So cash bail really has a negative impact on the entire economy, on the human lives of people, and on Michigan as a whole.
Kimberly, the legislature just passed a reform package that does a number of different things. It addresses mandatory minimum sentencing, rolling back some of the heavier sentences that have been part of the code. It did propose making it easier for people to get a suspended driver's license back. It looks like the governor nixed that. Can we focus on that driver's license issue for just a moment? How much of a problem are suspended licenses?
Oh, it's a huge problem here in Michigan. It's one of the leading reasons that people are actually arrested and detained pre-trial. It certainly has a massive racial impact as well. It's one of the top reasons that Black men are arrested and incarcerated in Michigan jails, which is absolutely ridiculous, because there's nothing about driving on a suspended license that indicates anybody is a risk to society or a danger, or that somebody will not actually show up for a hearing. And that's the whole point of detaining a person prior to them going into trial. So the racial disparities piece, the sheer number of folks that are being detained because of having a suspended license or having any issue related to traffic is just, it's astronomical in Michigan.
I want to pull back for a minute and think about the bigger picture. There were decades in which Michigan's elected leaders, along with those in other parts of the country, spent a lot of time trying to prove that they were tough on crime. And it appears what we're going through right now at the state level is a sea change. What do you think happened?
I think people just began to realize that those tough on crime policies and that mindset wasn't actually working, and it never did. There's a momentum here for criminal legal reform, and it's happening both in the state of Michigan, but across the country, generally speaking. I think more and more folks are starting to know folks that have a criminal record. It's estimated something like 2/3 of the population has a criminal record of some kind, and there's so many devastating collateral consequences to that. And understanding the impact of what these tough on crime laws have done and the detriment that it's caused to so many people's lives, I believe it's just a time where advocates have finally been able to get together and really push for these reforms.
Given everything that just passed in the legislature and the governor's no on the suspended license bill, what do you think are the logical next steps at the statewide level in the pace of reform?
Well, the next step is to get this cash bill legislation moving. And so as soon as the legislature gets back, I know that that is looking to be a big priority. This is something that the Michigan legislature has been working on for many, many years. There's a diverse range of coalition partners and organizations and stakeholders who are anxious to see this, to see movement happen. And it's something that's going to take not just the legislature, but it takes, as we've seen in Washtenaw County, it takes the prosecutors, it takes the sheriff's departments, it takes everybody to really get behind it and do their piece. And certainly there is, which is kind of the scary thing, there's a funding component to it as well. And so we need to make sure that we're allocating the right resources to make sure that we can get this legislation passed and really have a positive impact.
Kimberly Budden is Policy Counsel with the American Civil Liberties Union of Michigan. Kimberly, thank you.
Thank you.
And that's Stateside for today. Our program is produced by Aaron Allen, Mike Blank, April Van Buren, and by our director, Mercedes Mejia. Our interns are Catherine Nguyen, Nell Ovitt, and Olive Scott. The executive producer is Laura Weber Davis. Stateside's a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm April Baird. We'll see you next time. Take care.